From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Bradley George, filling in for Celeste Headlee. The story became a classic. A New York lawyer in rural Alabama defending his young cousins at a murder trial.
Is it possible the two Utes...
Two what? Did you say Utes?
Yeah, two Utes.
What is a Ute?
Oh, excuse me, Your Honor. Two youths.
That's Joe Pesci playing Vinny Gambini in My Cousin Vinny. The movie was set in Alabama but shot in Georgia 25 years ago. Its enduring appeal is being honored with a screening this weekend at the Atlanta Film Festival. Director Jonathan Lynn joins us later this hour. But first, yesterday we talked about a new call center to help prevent veteran suicides, largely staffed by people who haven't served in the military. Iraq vet Chris Dorsey told us that for him, the best counseling comes from other veterans.
You know, when we get out of the military, we left ultimate trust. That person to our right or left of us, we're willing to die for them and they for us. When we get out in the civilian world, that trust rarely exists. And when we have another veteran that is out there in a, you know, mental health field, we can relate to them.
Here are your first thoughts. Listener C. Lee told us he served three tours in Iraq.
After I got out, I became a psychotherapist and I practiced in Macon, Georgia. I'd just like to see a lot more veterans get into mental health. You know, a lot of people complain about or talk about the importance of having a veteran to talk to and then don't themselves use their GI Bill to go become a therapist.
We always want to know what you think. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. In the last year, a nonprofit abortion and birth control clinic has expanded its presence in the South. CareFem has opened clinics in Atlanta and Augusta, and it's hoping to reduce the stigma of abortion through an aggressive media campaign. Here to talk more about this is Melissa Grant. She's CareFem's Vice President of Health Services. Melissa, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
A number of states are putting restrictions on abortion clinics, and some have closed down as a result. I'm wondering why you're taking these steps to expand in the South and especially in Georgia.
Well, that's exactly because of all the restrictions that CareFem looked at where we would place our next health centers. When we envisioned CareFem as a new women's health care provider, we did so because of the number of health care centers that had closed. We know that with over 200 restrictions placed since the year 2011 on abortion and women seeking this option, clinics were closing across the country. So we wanted to be able to provide another option for women to receive care.
What sort of restrictions are there in Georgia?
The restrictions that are in Georgia are not quite as severe as many of the surrounding states. Laws that have been passed include waiting periods, state-mandated counseling sessions, parental notification options, certainly which we have in Georgia. But thankfully, we've been able to, at least so far, avoid some restrictions that would have required basically building health centers that are similar to hospitals in order to provide an outpatient surgical procedure or even to provide a pill.
Is it challenging at all? I mean, I know a lot of your group's work is focused on breaking some of the stigmas that exist around abortion and around birth control and family planning. Just from a business standpoint, trying to find office space or financing for these clinics, is that a challenge at all in a state like Georgia?
I think that across our country now, stigma associated with abortion is alive and well. And so certainly this is not a form of healthcare that people go into readily. There are many, many challenges. And the South and the Midwest probably have more than the rest of the country. That was one of the reasons, honestly, that we thought that it was most important that we provide services in these areas because there were not options for women there.
Right. And I want to take a listen to one of your media campaigns. This is from a video. It features three women gathered around a coffee table, and there's a fourth woman who's listening into their conversation.
Mm-hmm. I heard she had appendicitis.
Well, I heard she went to the countryside.
Appendicitis.
Oh, wait a minute. You guys are talking about abortion.
Because there's no shame in it. Abortion. Yeah, we do that.
But Melissa, what's the conversation you're trying to start around abortion, and what specifically are there certain groups of women that you're trying to reach?
Well, I think, first of all, we're speaking to people that might be looking to receive these services. And across the United States, we've known that stigma has associated shame and repressed conversation around abortion as an option. We also know that almost 1 in 3 women in the United States will have an abortion in her reproductive lifetime. So because of the incongruency between those two things, we wanted to point that and exactly that out. So by using a video that kind of tongue-in-cheek poked at that message a little bit to say, this is common. We should be able to talk about it openly. It allowed us to get our message out to people who hopefully will agree with us and help to combat that stigma and maybe open up conversation a little more broadly.
What sort of response have you received to that message?
For the most part, overwhelmingly positive. CareFM has a very strong online presence. We have a strong social media presence. And many of our clients have told us they've found us through some of these marketing campaigns, that while not every woman needs an abortion right now, when she hears a very supportive message, she remembers it and then passes that along to friends and family members or remembers it for herself when the time comes.
So there are abortion clinics, and there are these centers are known as pregnancy resource centers that are championed by pro-life groups. And we spoke earlier this year to Emily Mattson of the Georgia Life Alliance, and she explained from her view the differences between abortion clinics and pregnancy resource centers.
The abortion clinic's option, you go in, you pay your money, you're purchasing an abortion. The pregnancy resource center, you're going in, you're not paying anything, you're getting an opportunity to sit down, usually with another woman, usually who has faced the same decision, and talk about why do you feel you can't carry this pregnancy? If you do carry this pregnancy to term, what are your options?
Melissa, I want to give you a chance to respond to that. Do you think that's an accurate description that happens of what happens at CareFM clinics?
I believe that, honestly, women do have conversations in our atmosphere probably more openly than they would in a traditional crisis pregnancy center because we are non-judgmental. We support them no matter what option they would like to pursue. So, yes, we have conversations with women about their decision to choose an abortion or about their life going through an unintended pregnancy. We also know many women facing an unintended pregnancy are receiving health care, particularly low-income women, for the first time in a long time. So we do screening around all kinds of health care and social service needs for our clients. So I don't think that that message is accurate. The only part of it is true is that we certainly would provide an abortion if that's what the woman wanted, and that's the message we're trying to get out with our media.
You mentioned at the beginning of this interview that that many of the restrictions that exist in places like mm-hmm. Texas, for example, that's not mm-hmm. the case here in Georgia. Do you wonder at all that taking this kind of approach where you're being very forthright about what the services you are that you're providing, that might raise the ire of opponents here, particularly conservative Republicans who control the majority in our state legislature, and that they might enact some of those restrictions that we've seen in other states here in Georgia?
Well, frankly, I'd say that CareFM is focused on the health and well-being of our women that need us, our clients, and not our critics, and that previously not speaking to those critics has not in any way slowed them down on the offensive. So I also would tell you, as a healthcare professional, I know firsthand women don't make these decisions lightly. So we need to be able to reach out to them with open, honest conversation about their healthcare options and what's available to them. And that's the mission that CareFem is really trying to put forward first.
We're talking with Melissa Grant. She's Vice President of Health Services for CareFem. It's a group that has opened two abortion clinics recently in Georgia, in Atlanta and Augusta. That Augusta clinic, Melissa Grant, I imagine that also could serve women in South Carolina who might not have access to abortion services there.
It already has. I can tell you that currently CareFM sees about 18% of our clients traveling over 100 miles to receive care in our health centers. And so, again, that was one of the reasons why Georgia was a place to look at. We knew women were driving from Mississippi, from Alabama, and certainly from the Carolinas and even northern Florida. So we have already served South Carolina women in our Augusta Health Center.
And that was sort of the rationale from opening your first clinic in the Washington, D.C. area, wasn't it?
That's correct, because we're actually in Maryland, and Maryland and Washington, D.C. have less severe and unnecessary restrictions in place, Virginia was seeing more and more, and so we knew we would draw from that tri-state area. What did surprise us, however, was how far we would draw women driving from surrounding states that had even more challenging circumstances. So seeing women drive as far away from Ohio and Missouri was surprising to us, but we're meeting other needs as best we can.
Do you worry that putting your message out on social media in such a vocal way that could potentially put staff and put your group at risk?
I think there have been risks associated with providing this care for decades, and that hasn't changed simply because we talk about it. We're hoping that actually the opposite will happen, that by speaking out loud about the service we provide and normalizing it, speaking about it in the same way that hospitals and medical offices have talked about their services for years, we'll actually normalize the service we offer and in that way combat the stigma.
Do you have plans to expand anywhere else?
We're certainly always looking at that as a possibility. We know that there are not many new centers that provide abortion being built. Due to the current political landscape and changes that seem to happen so fast right now, it's hard to keep track. I don't have concrete plans, but we will evaluate and had several women in various states reaching out to us asking if we will bring a care of them there.
Well, you mentioned those political concerns, and there are concerns that if Neil Gorsuch is confirmed to the Supreme Court, that Roe versus Wade could be overturned. How have those concerns affected your mission?
I think that's always been in the back of our minds, as there is a vocal, what we have believed to be a minority, looking for ways to challenge abortion rights access in this country. So certainly as each concrete step moves forward, we have to look very strategically at where it's most likely rules would impact our business model. And in that way, the plans change. But we'll do the best we can to look at the environment as it exists now and to try to predict. We do know one thing for certain, and that's that women will continue to need this service regardless as to what kind of restrictions are put into place where they live.
What's the biggest challenge that you've faced so far in opening these clinics?
I think some of the biggest challenges, honestly, is making sure that we can reach out to the women that need us. That oftentimes anti-choice activists have obfuscated the messages online about where to go for an abortion and have used messages that oftentimes imply that they provide that care in their office. So by being so forthcoming and so to the point about we provide abortion or abortion, yeah, we do that, that's helped people to find us. So that's been part of our mission, to have that loud and unapologetic voice. We do this here.
Are the conversations that you have with women in the South about abortion different than the conversations that you would have with women, say, in suburban Washington?
You know, honestly, again, as a healthcare professional, I've been doing this for over 25 years, and what I've found is that each woman's individual circumstances are uniquely her own. And so it's not necessarily something that I would say regionally is hugely different as to why women might choose an abortion. The challenges may be unique, and some of those include not being able to find something close to her community and taking large amounts of time from work, school, family, et cetera, in order to incorporate this into her lifestyle, particularly when low-income women are the hardest hit overall with access to family planning and abortion care. So those needs speak strongly to me from women in the South and across the Midwest, more so maybe than the coast. In some places, those needs are universal.
That's Melissa Grant. She's Vice President of Health Services for the Abortion and Birth Control Clinic, CareFM. Melissa, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, we'll talk with the director of the classic Southern film. It feels weird for me to say that. I saw it when it came out when I was 12 years old. My Cousin Vinny, starring Joe Pesci. But first, Nina Simone's life and music embodied in four actresses. It's a new play that's on the stage right now in Atlanta, and we'll talk with some of the folks behind it coming up in just a few minutes. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Bradley George, and for Celeste Headlee, one of the luminous icons of the 20th century was pianist, singer, songwriter, activist Nina Simone. During the Civil Rights Movement, she was the voice of and for many frustrated African Americans, and a new musical in Atlanta tells her story from the very beginning.
Loving is the thing I crave. For your love, I'd be your slave.
Oh, give me some.
Give me some.
Oh, yeah. I can't stand it no longer.
Give me some.
called Simply Simone, which opens Saturday night at the Theatrical Outfit in Atlanta. And joining us this morning to talk about it is the show's director and choreographer, Pedro Harris. And with him are two of the four actresses playing Nina Simone, Shawnee Meissanet and Chelsea Reynolds. Thank you all for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much
Hi.
For having us.
Hello.
In this show, we're introduced, as we said, to four versions of Nina Simone at different periods of her life. And here's a clip from the show to give people a sense of how that plays out.
They call me Nina. Nina Simone.
Dr. Nina Simone, if you please.
And what I am is a black classical pianist.
The queen of African-rooted classical music.
Hard to believe that the woman standing before you came into this world in the back of a shack with no running water in the boondocks of Tryon, North Carolina.
Pedro, starting off, why was it important to have four women tell the story of Nina Simone's life?
Well, I think it's the essence of Nina. So if you could speak to yourself when you were 10, 20, and 30, and 40, what would you say to yourself? And in this interpretation, we get a chance to get the involvement of all of your whole self speaking back to your life, and it comes out really great.
Shawnee and Chelsea, what kind of preparation did you all do to prepare for playing her, Nina Simone?
Just a lot of researching, more so the videos of her interviews. I did a lot of even studying the script, exercising and preparing because I know what kind of director and choreographer Pedro is, and just preparing yourselves to go all in.
Right.
Shawnee?
Yes. So I knew her music, but knowing her music was not enough. You had to dig way deeper. So watching videos and clips of her took you into this whole nother world that is... It's so, like, mesmerizing to see the journey that she went on, to see what backed the way that she was, because she had this persona that everyone thought, wow, this is one type of person. But if you dig deeper, man, she had some, you know, strength to her.
Absolutely.
So let's get into that a little bit more. So Chelsea, you play one of the younger versions of Nina.
Yes, I play her youngest version.
And where is she at in her life when we meet you?
I start off really young, in a sense of you knowing a child that would roll on the floor, literally. That's me, just a very playful, hopeful, jolly child with a big dream. That's me in the beginning. She started playing the organ at a young age, or the piano, and being the pianist, the musician at her mom's church. So she started at a very young age. I go from that age up into auditioning for college and preparing for that. So that's the role that I take as Nina Simone.
And all of the Ninas jump around, so it's not in chronological
order.
So you jump around, and then she may Nina 1 may have an issue, but Nina 4 may say the answer.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so it's an interesting mix the way the playwrights are giving it to us, and we really like that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
We actually have a clip here of Nina Simone. This is from an interview with her in 1984, and she talks about some of her earliest memories of music, and just telling for our director here, this is clip number 8.
3 years old, I remember a piano came into the house, and I was a child, so I didn't know who bought the piano. And I remember playing God Be With You Till We Meet Again in the key of F. And of course, I didn't know what the key was. So I leave that for you to scramble.
Yeah. Chelsea, did you get that point in your portrayal where you felt some of that same excitement that Nina must have felt when she started performing music?
Absolutely. Most definitely. I think for me, I started music at a young age as well, so I can definitely relate to the excitement and having nothing but a dream, you know, not really knowing where it's going to take you, but knowing that you have the desire and the hope to be as great as she turned out to be.
Shawnee, where is your Nina at when we meet her in the play?
I play Nina around her, like, 20s to 30s age. It's at a time when she has discovered her gift, but she doesn't know where it's going to take her, and she needs to get out. She's ready for her to get out the house. She grew up in this really, she had a minister mother, so she was really well kept, but she wanted to be free. So it's at the moment where she's gone to these auditions. She's
she's become this jazz singer, although she wants to be a classical music, you know, classical pianist. She just wants to break away and find who she is. And so you find a lot of excitement, and yet she keeps getting, you know, backburned. And so she keeps with racism, mm-hmm. and, you know, many political views that when she's trying to audition for the Curtis Institute of Music, she's obviously talented, and so talented that they're, you know, surprised, but she's rejected because of her color. Mm-hmm. And you will get to see how she feels in that moment with Chelsea, and she plays that exact rejection and how the ladies around her feel towards her. And it's so, wow, it just takes you back, right. You know?
Just the human element of balancing your entire life, all your dreams, your whole community, your family, everybody mm-hmm. in your town supporting you, and you get there and they stop you because of your color.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's a hard balance in life.
Hard, yep.
What for you, Shawnee and Chelsea? What was the most challenging part of doing this show?
Yes, most definitely. I think for me, and it's something that I enjoy. Period. As an actress, being able to, I think in my real life or on the natural side of Chelsea, I'm sometimes vulnerable. I'm sometimes to myself, but in this. And with the piece that we're doing, you're vulnerable all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to move from one emotion to the next emotion, and you have to keep it going. And it can be a challenge because sometimes you want to get swallowed up in the moment, but you have to keep it moving. So I think that's one of the great challenges, something that makes you greater in the end as a performer, as an actress, as a musical artist. Just the challenge to be vulnerable, but at the same time be able to be versatile and keep it pushing.
Right.
Shawnee?
Same thing like she said, really digging into who mm-hmm. she is and stripping away 2017.
Yes.
What 2017 yeah. is like, going way back to, you know, their mannerisms in the day, what you could and could not do. There was a certain Absolutely. Standard to what, you know, that we could, you know, people of color could do. We couldn't, well, same thing now. We can't, you know, act out a certain way, and, you know, we can't be, they were more self-conscious about the things that they did back then. And so we have to kind of reel ourselves back. And that's pretty much the.
Yeah. In culture, you know, we move musically. Like mm-hmm. now we move very syncopated. Pop, 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 pop. Back then it was eighth notes, and I mean half notes and quarter notes. So we find thank you, good to me. So the language and the movement, they yes. matched. So to reel them back to that period just so they can get that every day to walk and talk and breathe and be classy and etiquette, because she was educated
right.
and very
exactly.
she was very elegant. You know,
Absolutely.
She was groomed in a way that she would be very elegant. So to get them that quality that's different than how we do it now.
Mm-hmm.
So
Absolutely.
To walk them back in history every single day. So we have things at rehearsal. We would rehearse things on our diction. We would say, I think, like, titillate your appetites with Dottie Stacy Tidbits, you know, so we could get all those things out, you know.
And then yes. jump around history, as you're saying, because it doesn't move
yes,
in a chronological
exactly.
And everybody plays, even though she was Nina 1, Chelsea's Nina 1, she's had to do things with Nina 4.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like, she's in the play, she'll go back and sings her life about being the other woman.
Mm-hmm.
Nina 1 sings that song. So it's a good mixture of,
Absolutely.
But the kindness and the love stays true
yes.
to Nina 1.
Absolutely.
You know?
We're talking about Nina Simone, and you play at Theatrical Outfit in Atlanta. Simply Simone tells the story of the life through her music, and musically she had such a distinct vocal style.
Absolutely.
Shawnee and Chelsea, I wonder for you, what was the challenge? You know, you don't want to, you have your individual styles, you have your individual voices.
Yeah.
Was there any temptation, though, to try to replicate the way that she sings?
Absolutely
yeah.
not. So, The libretto that we received is merely a foundation, just mm-hmm. A layout of what the composer wanted. So he specifically asked for us to be our own artists.
Yep.
So we're speaking, we're singing and acting the way, in essence, of Nina, but they mm-hmm. allowed for us to be our own artists because Nina is one of a kind, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. no one can, you know, duplicate, replicate anything that she did. But to carry on her essence is really important.
Shawnee, anything you want to add to that?
Chelsea. Yes.
Oh, it's Chelsea. I'm sorry.
You're okay.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I was looking at Shawnee and then looking at and saying your name. I'm sorry.
No,
I'm
you're
so
just
sorry.
Fine. I'll say when you first get the job, you're wondering, am I supposed to
exactly.
try, you know? But in the end, as Shawnee said, they did give us the privilege of being able to stay true to who we are, but definitely embodying how she felt in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
How she would have sung it more so on the emotional side, the mental side, where she was. That's more so where we're coming from, but we get to stay true to who we are as well and hopefully do her justice when we do the play.
So there's one turning point in her life, and it's the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing in Birmingham
yes.
in 1963. Mm. We played this clip before, but I'm going to play it again because it illustrates that point in the show.
Addie Mae Collins.
Blood on the leaves.
Carol Robertson.
And blood at the roof.
Cynthia Wesley.
Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze.
And Denise McNair.
Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
Patra, what does that moment do to Nina Simone? What is that moment in her life?
Strange fruits. She was a master at taking emotion and words and lyric and music and making them have a great marriage. And in Strange Fruit, you know, you hear it, it sounds like and it feels like what's going on. A lot of times in music, you know, we can get a great idea, but in that moment of talking about strange fruit, people of color being hung from trees, mm-hmm. which will make the strange fruit. And Shawnee does a great rendition of it and moving that way and interpreting that way. But in our version of it, it's very moving. It's one of the most difficult moments in the play. Sometimes mm-hmm. the actors are crying at rehearsal because it's just hard to evolve and let that come out of you. We always talk about being a vessel and not a container. Mm-hmm. So you have to be a vessel and let all those emotions move through you, but still keep going, which makes it very difficult.
Shawnee, yes. It sounds like a pretty intense moment in the show.
Oh, my goodness, it is. It's probably one of the toughest songs that I've had to perform because it's not, you have to strip away all of that technique and deal with the issue at the moment. And to be true to that moment, it's kind of like being naked on stage. You just have to let it go. Just, you know, it makes you that vulnerable. And to picture these types of situations where people are hanging from trees, people are standing around looking at the bodies, or, you know, just passing by and you might see your brother. Like, that takes it, you know.
Well, we're also hearing the names of the four girls that
exactly.
were killed in the 16th Street Baptist Church.
Takes you to right. another place.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and the people who were lost, I tell them in this moment, I said, for everybody do not have a voice. The people who were on the side of the road that mm-hmm. we never heard their names,
absolutely.
That they were lost in the bushes, who were people who were raped, people who mm-hmm. were murdered, babies who were killed. You are the voice of those people.
You know, you've talked about some of the racism that Nina Simone faced, but this particular moment, the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing, 1963, what kind of turning point was that for her in her life? Do we see that in the show? Do we see this kind of evolution from where she was to where she got to?
Definitely.
We get like a piece of history because, yes, she was, you know, even though it's her life, she's living around what's going on in America, the reason that pushes us to go other places where people just accept you. And when you can do something so heinous that way, to go and bomb a church mm-hmm. where people are trying to love and care for each other. There's nothing against anybody, mm-hmm. just trying to open their hearts. And it's children. They haven't even lived their lives. That lets you know what kind of America at that point we're living in, we should all be aware of.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes. I would have to say, so this was a turning point for her because she realized before this happened, she put herself well, you know, she was well put together. But after situation, hangings, bombings, all this stuff happened, she automatically switched into this activist person that she became. She listened to Lorraine, she listened to Langston Hughes, and she lashed back.
Absolutely.
Chelsea and Shawnee, what did you learn about Nina Simone doing the show that you didn't know going into it?
I think I learned more about her human side. Mm-hmm. I had watched the documentary, and it only gave kind of one, it was one-sided a little bit, you mm-hmm. know. It did kind of make her look more like a bad person in some senses, you know. And when I took the script, I read it, I got to act it out and go over it a couple times with the mm-hmm. girls. The more you hear it too with the repetition, it definitely opens your eyes to different things. For me, she was strong, as she said. She had a heart, you know, as Shawnee said a second ago, after so many different occasions of being let down and the murders and everything else that was going on around her, built her into the anger and the hurt and the disappointment that she felt. But she was definitely a loving person who had a big dream and in reality just wanted to be accepted and loved for what she did and who mm-hmm. she was outside yeah. of just her color.
All right, that's Shawnee Meisene. We also heard from Chelsea Reynolds, two of the actresses playing Nina Simone in the musical Simply Simone. We also heard from director and choreographer Patro Harris. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
And Simply Simone opens Saturday at 7:30 at Theatrical Outfit in downtown Atlanta.
Birds flying high, you know how I feel. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me, yeah. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me. Ooh, 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 ooh. And I'm feeling good. Fish in the sea, you know how I feel. River running free, you know how I feel. Blossom on the tree, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me, and I'm feeling good. Dragonfly out in the sun, you know what I mean, don't you know? Butterflies all having fun, you know what I mean? Sleep in peace when day is done, that's what I mean. And this old world is a new world and a bold world for me. When you shine, you know how I feel. Scent of the pine, you know how I feel. Oh, freedom is mine, and I know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Bradley George, filling in for Celeste Headlee. I hope you'll join us tomorrow. We'll talk about the news of the week and about a bill to prevent universities from investigating allegations of rape on campus. We want to hear from you. You can leave a message at 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. And be sure to join us tomorrow morning for that conversation. This weekend, the Atlanta Film Festival pays tribute to a courtroom classic. My Cousin Vinny premiered 25 years ago to critical and popular acclaim. The movie, which was filmed in Monticello, Georgia, tells the story of an inexperienced New York attorney who takes on the biggest case of his career, a murder trial.
What kind of law do you practice?
Well, up till now, personal injury.
You're a trial attorney, right? I mean, personal injury trials.
Well, actually, this would be my first foray into the trial process.
That's actor Joe Pesci playing the attorney Vinnie Gambini. On Sunday, the Atlanta Film Festival shows My Cousin Vinnie as part of the annual Food on Film series. Here to talk about the movie, 25 years on, is director Jonathan Lynn. He joined us from his home in New York and talked with On Second Thought host Celeste Headlee.
So you had not only the challenge of understanding American culture, but a subset of American culture. How did you approach that?
Well, I suppose as a foreigner, I didn't see a lot of difference between the various American cultures. As you know, Hollywood history is littered with European directors who have made American films.
Mm-hmm.
Billy Wilder and Michael Curtiz and Fred Zinnemann and Milos Forman, and the list is absolutely endless, as you know. And to me, the difference between the North and the South was not all that significant. What I found when I read the script was it was a film about class, which, of course, the Brits really know about. Vinny and Lisa are both working class. They're both ex-garage mechanics. He's become a lawyer. She's become a hairdresser. In the South, they're up against an establishment of old money. The judge went to Yale. The prosecutor is Jim Trotter III. I saw a lot of class issues in the script.
That is fascinating to me. I want to play a clip real quick that may demonstrate what you're talking about. This is actually one of the many run-ins that Vinny has with the judge, played by Fred Gwynne. In this scene, Vinny has come in wearing this very outdated, brightly colored, almost fuchsia suit, and the judge takes him to task. Let's take a listen.
Are you mocking me with that outfit?
Mocking you? No, I'm not mocking you, Judge.
Then explain that outfit.
I bought a suit. You've seen it. Now it's covered in mud. This town doesn't have a one-hour cleaners, so I had to buy a new suit. Except that the only store you could buy a new suit in has got the flu. You get that? The whole store got the flu. So I had to get this in a secondhand store.
So I saw that as a clash of cultures, a New York culture coming up against a Southern culture. You saw that as a clash of class.
I saw it as both. I think it's Brooklyn versus Alabama. But I think it's also a class issue. I think as a blue-collar guy, Vinny didn't have any problem with appearing in court in a very nice leather jacket, very expensive leather jacket. The judge said a leather jacket wasn't permissible. It had to be a suit. The judge is very old school. Vinny is a New Yorker. But it's also a class thing.
So the reason why it's being shown as part of the Food on Film series, I think, is a guess because of this scene about grits, and grits are about as Southern as you can get. Let's take a listen to that scene.
What's this over here?
You never heard of grits?
Sure, I heard of grits. I just actually never seen a grit before. Come on, honey, you can try it.
You first.
Did you have any grit? Did you taste grits before you filmed this scene?
I have tasted grits, yes.
Did you like them? How do you eat your grits?
Well, I don't want to insult your audience, but it's not my favorite food, I have to say. I can appreciate, but then I don't like oatmeal either. Perhaps I'm just averse to that kind of...
bland breakfast food.
that kind of stuff, yes. But that's not the point. You don't have to try everything yourself in order to be able to direct a scene about it. Really, the thing about making a movie as a foreigner is that, unlike on stage, where you have to create the environment, the set, the ambiance, and everyone has to pretend to be something they're not, we went to the South. We actually went to Georgia to make the film, to Atlanta or Monticello, rather than Alabama, because Georgia has a film industry. But essentially, you go to where you're shooting, and it's what you are shooting. You don't have to have pretense. I went to a murder trial near Atlanta, and watched it for 3 or 4 days as part of my prep for the movie. And in fact, the courtroom that we built for the film is pretty much the same as the courtroom that I saw a real murder trial in. And I watched the whole procedure. I watched the way they selected the jury. I watched the behavior of the judges and the judge and the lawyers. And it's not that hard, whether you're a foreigner or an American, to shoot something that's there in reality. And then you have the advantage of American actors, you know, who know how to play those parts, who do understand the culture. So for me, it's all just a question of storytelling.
I'm speaking with filmmaker Jonathan Lynn. His 1992 film, My Cousin Vinny, turns 25 this year, and it's being honored with a special screening at this weekend's Atlanta Film Festival. Let's take a listen to a scene from the film. We see several breakdowns throughout the movie of East Coast versus Southern dialect. Probably the most memorable exchange on that is in the courtroom between attorney Vinny Gambini and Judge Holler. Here's Gambini examining a witness.
Is it possible the two youths.
To what? What was that word?
What word?
To what?
What?
Did you say youths?
Yeah, two youths.
What is a ute?
Oh, excuse me, Your Honor. Two youths.
So, over the past 25 years, how has your, has your view of this film changed? I mean, how has it weathered for you?
My view of this film has improved, I think. At the time we finished it, it was a tremendous battle to get it out there. It was a not very expensive film, well below average budget.
Are you saying it was a battle to get enough press and attention to the film? Is that what you mean?
Oh, yes, it was. It was very hard to get the film to open. We didn't have recognized stars. We were opening round about the same, I think it was either the same week or the week before or after Pretty Woman with Julia Roberts, which was causing a sensation. And it was very hard to get to encapsulate what made the film work so well. The studio, I think, were amazed when we did our first test screening because we got scores that went through the roof and the audience was euphoric about it. And, you know, it had not been a very important film in their schedule. And so there was the release date. They rethought. The release date was postponed by 3 or 4 months. And Joe Roth, who was chairman of the studio, did something really, I thought, daring and clever. He said, the only way we can sell this film is by showing it to people and getting good word of mouth. So they did, I think it was 900 screenings all over America, free screenings. And people came to them, and they got people in one way or another, and people came out of the screenings and talked about the movie, so that by the time we opened, there was great word of mouth.
Did that strategy worry you? Were you afraid the film wasn't going to make money?
You're always afraid that every film isn't going to make money. it was my third film, I didn't know such a lot about film marketing. I did know that they were right when they said the way people will be interested in this film is if their friends tell them to go see it. It was very hard to come up with a trailer that captured the mood and the sense of the film and how funny it is and how well it develops. But anyway, you asked me if my view of the film had changed over the years. I think I like it more as time goes by. I don't see it very often, but on the rare occasions that I've watched it, I've been pleased with the work we did, and I can't always say that about. You know, usually you look at your own work and you think, oh, I wish I'd changed this, or I wish I hadn't done that, or you know, you have all kinds of thoughts. I wish I'd cut that scene more. most strictly. You know, there's all kinds of things that you see that you can improve. And when I look at Vinny, I'm pleased with it.
Did you know that some teachers are using My Cousin Vinny as a teaching aid for young lawyers?
I did. I'm a recovering lawyer myself. I have a degree in law, and I was very keen that it should be legally absolutely accurate. But I was surprised about 15 years ago when I got invited to speak on a panel at a convention of judges. And it was something to do with the way Hollywood presents trials and the law. And I discovered that they all really love My Cousin Vinny. Then I discovered that Justice Scalia, this was his favorite film.
Antonin Scalia, the former Supreme Court justice.
Yes, yes. So, you know, at least he got one thing right. And I do have a friend who's a federal judge in South Carolina who is a fan of this film to such an extent that he went to the Sack of Suds, which is the convenience store where the two boys were accused of stealing at the beginning of the movie and of murdering the clerk. And he went to the Sack of Suds and bought the sign. And it now hangs in his chambers.
A federal judge has the Sack of Suds sign in his chambers?
Yes. And he teaches evidence at various law schools. And he always uses My Cousin Vinny. And then this winter, I couldn't go, unfortunately, but I was invited to speak at a big convention in South Carolina by the retiring Chief Justice there, who it turns out is also an enthusiast about the movie. And it seems that they all regard it as the... I'm quoting them, you understand. This is not my opinion. They all say it's the most accurate film about a trial that's ever been made. It's the only film they've ever seen where there are no legal mistakes.
Wow.
I think that's the reason they like it so much, but of course I can't be sure. But I do know they use it as a teaching aid in law schools everywhere. I can't claim all the credit for that, you understand. I mean, I didn't write the script.
Yeah, this wasn't
Dale
one of
Lorna
you.
Dale Lorna wrote the script.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you have an unusual number of films in your repertoire that have become cult classics, not just this one, but that people like to watch again and again and again. But there's also Clue. There's The Whole Nine Yards. Are you aware of something you're doing differently that makes something people still watch a movie and actually study a movie a quarter of a century later? Is that something that is conscious?
I don't know how to answer that because I ask myself that question. I'm constantly surprised at that several of my films seem to have acquired this sort of fanatical following. I get more emails and fan mail about Clue than I do even about My Cousin Vinny. And people seem to be absolutely obsessed with it.
Yeah.
It was my first film. That is a film I look at and see all kinds of things I should have done differently. But it's really nice that people still love it. The Whole Nine Yards, I think, works well. I'm pleased with The Whole Nine Yards. There's another film of mine that maybe my favorite, which was called Nuns on the Run, which is not shown here very much. It was a British movie with Robbie Coltrane and Eric Idle, and made by Handmade Films, which was George Harrison's company.
But also Yes, Prime Minister, which is incredibly popular, and people still... Yes, Minister and Yes, Prime Minister, a TV series, but still a bit of cult classic.
They are. I don't know how to explain it.
which means if people come to you asking what your secret is, you don't know.
No, I have absolutely no idea. I just do what I think is funny and interesting. We all know that comedy is about timing, but the difference in the timing of a funny take and an unfunny take of exactly the same line or exactly the same moment is huge. A director's job really is to be the audience of one. you do all kinds of things. You make all kinds of suggestions to the writer, or sometimes if I'm the writer, to myself, to the camera people, to the actors, to everything. But finally, what you are is the audience. And you sit by the camera or stand by the camera and you watch a take and you think, did that work? And if it didn't work, you have to ask yourself, why not? Was it too slow? Was it too fast? Was the timing of that wrong? Was the thought not clear? You ask yourself every possible question and then you do it again. And when you think that works, you move on. And beyond that, it's just, I don't think I'm able to describe the process.
That is Jonathan Lynn, director of the movie My Cousin Vinny. It's being shown Sunday at noon at the Plaza Theater in Atlanta. It's part of the Atlanta Film Festival's annual Food on Film series. You can get more details at gpbnews.org. Jonathan Lynn, such a pleasure. I thank you.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed talking to you.
And that's our show for today, but we want to hear from you. What is your favorite film that takes place in the South? You can call us at 404-500-9457. You can also post on Facebook or reach us on Twitter. The show is at OST Talk. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Bradley George, filling in for Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.